The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
Where did that energy best come from? It would best come from Alaska. There's no straits, there's no threats.
The U.S. Interior Secretary encourages oil and gas development during a stop in Anchorage. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Alaska House extends Typhoon Halong disaster assistance after a contentious vote.
Let me remind you of the body. These are Alaskans. Pass this resolution.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
The head of the U.S. Department of Interior visited Alaska today and spoke about Alaska's role in national and international energy security. Secretary Doug Burgum and his team were traveling to the U.S.-sponsored Indo-Pacific Energy Security Ministerial and Business Forum in Tokyo, Japan. They had a stopover at the Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport and were joined by Governor Mike Dunleavy. Burgum noted the increased importance of the conference with the ongoing war in the Middle East and its effect on energy markets. Burgum spoke to the press about the concept of energy dominance, saying the department's goal is to ensure that energy in the U.S. is affordable and reliable. And he says the department also wants U.S. allies and territories in the Pacific to have a secure energy supply.
Where did that energy best come from? It would best come from Alaska. There's no straits, there's no threats, there's no terrorist countries that are blocking it.
In response to a reporter's question, Burgum spoke about the proposed Alaska LNG project, a pipeline designed to transport natural gas from the North Slope to the Kenai Peninsula. Burgum says his team plans to talk to more companies about offtake agreements at the conference in Tokyo. A final decision on whether to build the proposed pipeline hasn't been announced. But he says the project is in progress.
It's real, it's moving ahead, and I'd say it's needed more than ever right now in the world because of what we're seeing. Energy dominance is about energy abundance. Alaska can play a huge role in that, and that's going to be, you know, great for Alaskans, great for America, and great for the world.
One aspect of the Department of Interior's work in Alaska is the Federal Subsistence Management System, which prioritizes hunting and fishing for rural residents on federal lands. The system is currently under review. The Safari Club International recently filed a petition to reform the Federal Subsistence Board by giving more weight to the state of Alaska. Burgum did not speak about the review specifically, but said in general the department is working to ensure Alaskans have more control over the decisions in their state without the federal government getting in the way. The secretary also spoke about the need for the Ambler Road to support development in that region and increase the supply of critical minerals. He says the need is more urgent, given China's control over the production of those resources. Burgum also said the federal government is discussing ways to finance the road, which he says is considered as a private corridor for the industry. The Alaska House passed a resolution yesterday extending Governor Dunleavy's disaster declaration related to the storms that wrought havoc in western Alaska last fall. The extension allows state agencies to continue responding to ongoing needs stemming from the storm. Debate over the measure was contentious. Minority Republicans largely opposed the extension on procedural grounds. Representative Justin Ruffridge, a Soldotna Republican, said extending the disaster declaration with a resolution rather than a bill would open it up to legal challenges.
With anything ongoing in Western Alaska, that is a clear need for funding, a clear need for support, a clear need for this state to rise up and do what needs to be done. This is about whether or not what we do here will withstand any challenge.
The dispute stems from the fact that the legislature was not in session in October when the remnants of Typhoon Halong hit the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Disaster declarations by the governor are only valid for 30 days, and lawmakers didn't return for their regular session until late January. While the legislature was out of session, the House Speaker and Senate President approved extensions of the declaration on lawmakers' behalf. House Republicans argued that means lawmakers have to pass a bill to make the extension valid. But members of the largely Democratic House Majority Coalition rejected the argument, saying Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy had requested the resolution. Representative Nellie Jimmy, a Democrat from Tuksuk Bay, representing the YK Delta, said she was disappointed by the debate.
The devastation of this storm left behind is unbelievable. So is this the way to debate is playing out today? Let me remind you, the body, these are Alaskans. Pass this resolution.
The House passed it 25-15, with mostly minority Republicans opposed. The extension now heads to the Senate, which is expected to approve it in the coming days. President Trump said this week that his top priority for Congress is to pass a bill called the Save America Act. It's about what credentials Americans need to show before they vote. But it's more than a voter ID law and has elements that would have an outsized effect in Alaska. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin joins us now with more. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Lori.
So, Liz, give us an overview here. What is the Save America bill?
The basic idea is to ensure that only U.S. citizens vote in federal elections. That's already the law. Proponents say this law would enforce it. It's become a huge rallying cry for conservatives.
Would it require proof of citizenship to vote?
No, not to vote. And I think a lot of people are confused about this. Earlier versions called for that. But let's talk about the version the U.S. House passed last month. It would require people to show proof of citizenship when they register to vote. And then to vote, a person would have to show photo ID, such as real ID, a driver's license, something like that.
Okay, so let's talk about the proof of citizenship that you have to show to register. What document would qualify here?
This may be the most stringent aspect of the bill, and it's meant to be. You can show a U.S. passport. Not everyone has one of those. You can also meet the requirement by showing government-issued photo ID, but only if it says your birthplace is the United States. And I'm not sure for most people what kind of photo ID they'd have that shows birthplace.
Can you just show your real ID, like a driver's license or state ID card?
You can show those to vote, but to register to vote, your Alaska Real ID would not suffice if this bill becomes law. That's because it doesn't say that you're a citizen, and it doesn't say you were born in the United States. Also, the bill says to register, you have to present these documents in person to an elections official. So you can still register by mail, but your registration isn't valid until you go to an office and show your documents before the registration deadline. If you live in a remote community, that might be difficult. In presidential elections, Alaska has same-day registration, so presumably you could register by mail and then you should be able to activate that by showing your proof of citizenship when you go to vote.
What about online voter registration, like Alaska's automatic registration with the permanent fund dividend application? Would somebody who gets registered that way still have to show up at an elections office in person with proof of citizenship?
The bill is not clear about online registration, so I don't know. I should also say that if you don't have a valid passport, the bill says you can show a combination of things to prove citizenship, like a photo ID plus a certified copy of your birth certificate or naturalization certificate.
President Trump keeps saying this bill would ban voting by mail. Is that true?
No, but the bill would make it harder to vote by mail. It says you'd have to send in a copy of your ID when you request a ballot and when you turn in that ballot. We know that historically, failure to get a witness signature is the biggest reason mailed ballots are rejected in Alaska, and that just requires access to a person. Getting access to a photocopy machine or a printer would add another level of difficulty.
The U.S. Constitution says that states control the times, places, and manner of elections. So would this law, if it was passed, survive a legal challenge?
That's a good question, and our own congressional delegation is divided on this. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she supports voter ID, but she says it's up to the states to decide what documents they'll accept to prove a voter is legit. She's taking a lot of heat these days for that opposition to the bill. Senator Dan Sullivan and Congressman Nick Begich, they are sponsors of the Save America Act. Begich says people should read the end of that constitutional clause. It says that Congress may at any time by law make or alter election regulations. And he says this bill is within the role the founders contemplated for Congress.
All right, Liz, what's the timeline on this for lawmakers?
The U.S. Senate is set to take it up next week. They'll likely have an initial vote, and it's not clear what happens after that. Republicans don't have 60 votes to get past a filibuster. There are calls to abolish the filibuster or to hold an old-fashioned talking filibuster. This could tie up the Senate for days.
Thanks for updating us on the current status of this, Liz.
You bet.
That was Alaska Public Media's Washington, D.C. correspondent, Liz Ruskin. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Girdwood students race through books as part of an Iditarod challenge.
Just like when the real mushers are racing, they have certain things they have to meet at each checkpoint.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news on Alaska News Nightly or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
The state of Alaska is suing six crowdfunding websites, accusing them of illegally soliciting donations for thousands of Alaska charities without consent. The Alaska Beacon reports that the Consumer Protection Unit of the Alaska Department of Law filed civil lawsuits in Anchorage Superior Court on Tuesday. The complaints allege that GoFundMe, PayPal, Charity Navigator, Pledgling Technologies, Just Giving, and Network for Good each violated the Alaska Charitable Solicitations Act thousands of times. The act requires state registration for anyone seeking donations on behalf of a charity. It was passed in the early 90s over concerns about telemarketers soliciting donations by phone. The complaints allege that the crowdfunding site scraped IRS data for information on thousands of Alaska nonprofits, then set up donation pages for each of those nonprofits without their consent. Part of a campaign that encompassed almost 1.5 million federally registered organizations across the country. The state is requesting that a judge order the sites to shut down the pages devoted to Alaska nonprofits and immediately disperse any donations to those nonprofits, according to the lawsuits. It also asks for separate civil penalties. Attorney General Designee Stephen Cox said the state became aware of the issue after an investigation by state officials and reporters in California over similar issues there. Almost 24 state attorney generals sent a letter to GoFundMe earlier this week asking for clarity about its policies, although Alaska did not sign that letter, saying it wasn't strong enough. The The Juneau Assembly has decided to postpone a vote on whether to disempower Eagle Crest Ski Area's Board of Directors for at least 6 months. That's after recent news that a preliminary cost estimate for the installation of the city-owned ski area's controversial gondola put the project's total cost at $37 million. When the city purchased the gondola in 2022, the project was estimated to cost under $10 million. Mayor Beth Weldon originally proposed an ordinance to reduce the status of the city-owned ski area's board from an empowered board to an advisory board in February. At the time, she cited recent leadership turnover at the mountain and ongoing financial issues. But at a meeting on Monday night, the mayor asked the assembly to push back voting on the topic for 6 months as the board faces major decisions in the coming months that could drastically change the ski area.
There's just a lot going on, and I don't think now is the time to tackle this issue with the board since we're tackling so many other issues.
Right now, as an empowered board, Eagle Crest has its own set of laws, rules, and responsibilities. If it became an advisory board, members could only make recommendations to the assembly. It would lose the authority to establish policies or make decisions without assembly approval. The assembly decided Monday that the vote on disempowerment will be pushed until late September. However, some assembly members, like Christine Wall, said delaying the decision could also cause issues.
I'm not opposed to postponing this. I don't think we're ready to make this decision to disempower them, but I do worry that this hanging out there is going to have impacts on their ability or inability to hire a GM.
The ski area is currently in the middle of hiring a new general manager. Its previous manager resigned in January after less than 2 years in the role. He did not give a public reason for his departure. The city is currently also in discussions with Gold Belt Incorporated, a local Alaska Native corporation. The city is asking for a larger investment in the gondola project. Gold Belt invested $10 million in the gondola in 2022 in exchange for a revenue-sharing agreement. Alaska's newest kelp nursery recently finished its first growing season in Kodiak. KMXT's Davis Hovey reports that the unusual nursery setup cost-effectively produces seed line for the island's kelp farmers and is boosting how much they can grow.
Once I'm in the nursery, I switch to my Crocs, and we're nursery Crocs all the way in here.
The nursery is a bright white 40-foot shipping container. Inside, Allie Conrad tends to baby kelp, growing in 10 uniform water tanks on her own, carefully adjusting light, temperature, and filtering contaminants out of hundreds of gallons of seawater. Green Wave, a national nonprofit, opened this first-of-its-kind nursery in Kodiak in August, with Conrad as its nursery manager and lead operator. It's Alaska's newest kelp nursery, often said interchangeably with hatchery. And the baby blue Crocs she wears? They help her produce quality kelp.
You know, we're pretty serious about biosecurity when we're in season because we want to make sure that we're producing the highest quality seed we can and reducing any risk of contamination. I mean, like every time we open the door, there's a risk of contamination, really.
Even on Halloween, when she danced to this song by Somber for an Instagram video in a hot dog costume with her lab coat, sterile gloves, and yes, her Crocs, all while rotating kelp spores and taking measurements. Every time she steps into the container, Conrad switches between street clothes and her lab clothes. In the fall, she grew millions of sugar kelp spores on 240 spools over the course of several weeks. The spores become baby kelp, and when that's healthy, it turns brown.
Like some of our best spools, I mean, I just started calling them chocolate bars because they just are solid chocolate brown.
Most of the kelp was ready by January, then it was transplanted to various local ocean kelp farm sites. By this summer, those kelp seedlings will reach maturity and grow into kelp strands several feet long, ready to harvest. Growing large quantities of quality kelp seed has been a challenge in Alaska, with few kelp hatcheries operating in the state. With this mobile container nursery, there are now 2 operational kelp hatcheries on Kodiak Island and 8 total statewide. Dave Bailey with GreenWave says that's part of why the national nonprofit launched in Kodiak.
Kodiak needed some more seed for the new buyers that were in town, and we really wanted to test out the infrastructure that we've been working on developing over the past couple of years, and we thought that it would be a great spot to sort of start up.
Bailey, who directs farmer advancement for GreenWave, says the nursery reduced the cost of kelp seed production to 41 cents per foot of seed line and made it more affordable for local farmers. According to local kelp farmers, buying kelp seed from elsewhere in the state usually costs a lot more, an average of 50 cents per linear foot. Farmers typically need thousands of feet of seed line to grow their kelp. Bailey says GreenWave might eventually hand off the container nursery to the recently formed Kodiak Ocean Growers Cooperative, which includes five farms around the island.
You know, we're just trying to, like, de-risk everything for them right now, sort of understand the cost of production, how much labor is required, everything like that, to see if it's actually something they want to take on moving forward.
Bailey says they're eyeing 2027 for the potential transfer. Right now, Conrad's labor is the biggest cost to running the nursery. Then Bailey says it's electricity, roughly $300 a month, and the Kodiak Seafood and Marine Science Center is not charging rent. Tollef Munson and his wife run a kelp farm in the co-op on the west side of Kodiak Island. Munson says he's looking forward to working collaboratively with the other farmers and the nursery to expand kelp production in Kodiak, which will allow them to meet the growing demand from buyers.
Yeah, we're talking, you know, in the hundreds of thousands of pounds with these buyers that are coming on. And we need to be able to support each other. So if one farm has some disaster help happen, we're not at a total loss for that buyer that, you know, has said, oh, I want 50,000 pounds from that farm or that farm.
Kodiak farmers expect to start harvesting their kelp in May. By August, Allie Conrad plans to begin her second growing season in her crocs in the GreenWave container, growing more kelp seed for next year. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
Soldotna's ice rink is getting an almost $250,000 makeover. That's after city council members signed off on funding for a laundry list of projects at the Soldotna Regional Sports Complex. The list comes from a report the city commissioned to study the ice arena, which is estimated to be 15 years past its usable life. Trevor Baldwin supervises operations for the city's Parks and Recreation Department. He grew up skating on the rink and says it's starting to show its age.
So it shows due diligence and maintenance that we have done to make our system last as long as we have, but it is time.
The study analyzed the full ice arena, which includes the refrigeration system, the ice rink floor, and the perimeter boards. Recommendations include expanding on-site freon storage, forward funding maintenance of the center's compressors, and rebuilding the spare compressor. That's on top of upgrading the arena's emergency lighting system and replacing the building's hot water tank. Baldwin says the city sometimes has trouble keeping up with the building's needs due to its age. Refrigerant Freon, for example, can no longer be produced or imported to the United States, which has made it harder to find. And he says some machinery parts are no longer being manufactured either. The Soldotna Regional Sports Complex is the home rink for the Kenai River Brown Bears, a Tier 2 Junior League hockey team. The rink is also open intermittently for public use and hosts learn to skate classes, local league practices, and school games. The council will convene at the end of the month for a work session to discuss the ice arena's future and long-term needs. About three dozen sled dog teams are on the 1,000-mile Iditarod Trail to Nome as part of this year's race, and thousands of people around the world are following along. Some of the spectators are kids participating in the Iditarod Challenge, and as Alaska Public Media's Ava White reports, that includes Girdwood students counting each minute spent with a book as a mile on the trail.
Girdwood 6th grader Solstice Martin has been reading along the trail for a few years now and loves to read anything adventurous.
I have some really interesting books that I'm into at home. Right now I'm reading some books from the Charlie Thorne series and I'm on the second book.
The names of the nearly two dozen Iditarod checkpoints line the wall near the school library and each student has a dog sled with their picture on it. As the students read, their trail mileage racks up and their sled moves along the trail, checkpoint to checkpoint. Just like the Iditarod teams, their goal is to make it to Nome. It's only a couple days into the month and Solstice is in the lead. Her sled is in cripple, meaning she's already read more than 425 minutes. It hasn't been hard for the 11-year-old.
Then it gives me an excuse to stay up all night and read.
The Girdwood School has been participating in the Iditarod for almost 20 years. Students started the challenge on March 1st and will continue through the end of the month when they're then celebrated with a party. The race trail is 1,000 miles, but Girdwood is along the 2,300-mile Iditarod National Historic Trail that stretches from Seward to Nome. It was used extensively during the Gold Rush era, Now, the route is primarily used for recreation and long-distance winter races. Girdwood librarian Megan Nedwick says that personal connection to their town gets students hooked, and they get more out of the program than reading.
Just like when the real mushers are racing, they have certain things they have to meet at each checkpoint, whether it's what they have in their sled or how long they're staying at that checkpoint. You know, there's rules. And so it's the same way with the Iditarod. And I always encourage them, like, do this because you want to do it and do it right. You know, do it with integrity and make sure you're honest.
Longtime Iditarod musher D.D. Jeanreau agrees. Her late mother, Peggy Stout, was an educator for more than 50 years and is the first known to hold an Iditarod challenge starting in the 1980s. Jeanreau says her mother was a bookworm who wanted to motivate young students.
Kids were excited about dog mushing. So she got the idea of if they could do a competition that somehow would unite the two excitements, that maybe she could get more kids to read more. That was her whole goal.
Jeanreau says you're never too old to be a learner. It's a message she hopes students take to heart, inspired by a piece of advice the late sprint champion George Atla gave her during a sled dog race early in her career.
George goes, you know, there's always something you can learn from anybody. And you're never too old to learn, and you never know enough.
Jeanreau says her mom would be thrilled to know about the enthusiasm for the Iditarod program from students like Solstice, the Girdwood leader, and Jackson Smith, who goes to Bayshore Elementary, where close to 300 students participate. Jackson says once he starts reading, he can't stop.
When I read, and when I read a lot, I just like kind of feel like in the story, and then I just keep reading.
Jackson plans on reading at least 30 minutes each day to make it to the Nome finish line, and if you need a reading recommendation to help you get there, Jackson recommends The Secret Zoo series by Brian Chick. In Anchorage, I'm Ava White.
And finally tonight, a correction to a story from last night about a bill that would alter a sexual assault law in Alaska. The story misstated the alleged victim associated with one of 16 criminal counts originally filed against former Juneau chiropractor Jeffrey Fultz. A jury acquitted Fultz on that particular count. A retrial on other charges is still pending. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Alona Niden and Ava White in Anchorage, Eric Stone and Clarice Larson in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Davis Hovey in Kodiak, and Ashlyn O'Hara in Soldotna. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde. Kirsten Dobroth is our producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.